Welcome back. This is still our MBA day, building Windows Store application for iOS developers. And we've switched speakers. So
yeah,
Eric?
I'm no longer Sean McCune in this position. It's Eric Jeffers. I am a trainer and engineer for Big Nerd Ranch. Been working on the Windows Core stuff for a while now, but I also dabble in Android and iOS as well.
And in this session, we're going to talk about C# for Objective-C developers. We've done our troubleshooting, so hopefully things will get better with regards to the debugger. And we're just going to go through, give you kind of an introduction to the C# language from an Objective-C standpoint, do a little bit of the mappings for the constructs that you're most familiar with. Before we start with C#, I do want to kind of preface it with .NET and what the .NET runtime is, because you'll hear Microsoft people talk about .NET, and it's very confusing how we talk about it. It's kind of a developer platform. It's a base class, a set of base class libraries that we use. So we talk about, .NET as being the class libraries. We talk about it being the runtime, the redistributable that goes on every Windows box. We also even use the term, .NET for the tooling, Visual mm-hmm. Studio. So it's a very kind of a complex or overused term, but and the reality is that it's all of those things. For you to think about it, it's all of those things coming together. And the platforms that it runs is on the Windows desktop. That means Windows desktop, as you know it, as before Windows 8 or in any version, and also on Windows Server. It also runs on Windows Azure on the cloud, and then we also run on a subset of that runtime runs on Windows Store and Windows Phone.
Right, and that the core CLR, I think, is what that's called, right?
Yep.
Right. And that is kind of like, for iOS developers, you could think about that as core foundation equivalent, in that it provides all of that same functionality.
Yep. And if we even run some of these on non-Microsoft platforms. So for example, the Xamarin guys take our specification C#, and they take our base class library and implement it for iOS and Android.
Yep.
So you'll see, especially for that core CLR, you'll see all of that functionality go across all the platforms with those tools. With regards to .NET languages, we're going to use the term managed language a lot. That just means it's running inside that managed runtime that .NET brings in. Our languages are all compiled. They all compile into intermediate language, and then they get just-in-time compiled when they're in the box.
Mm-hmm.
In some cases, we optimize where we have this thing called engine, where we compile. Once we install it in the box, we kind of engine so that it doesn't have to JIT compile every time. But in the end, you end up running something that's compiled, so you get really great performance out of it. All of our languages are object-oriented. They're all strong type. And the one thing they have, again, as part of that managed runtime, is they're all garbage collected.
Mm-hmm.
And for iOS people, or before we go into the next one, if you're looking at the two languages that fit into this environment for building Windows Store applications, we have Visual Basic .NET, which is kind of a modern version of Visual Basic, and then C#. And C# is the one we're going to talk about a lot. I just mentioned garbage collection, so I know iOS people immediately kind of like, started getting that crawl up their spine with like, oh, garbage collection. Here's what I have to say about garbage collection. First of all, if you don't know what it is, all it means is that you don't have to worry about allocating or deallocating your memory. The runtime is going to take care of that. You'll just start creating objects, put them on the heap, and then we will keep track of who's using those objects, and we will release them as we go. So that's where you're going to see. It's very non-deterministic, so that is the one thing that's different. If you're kind of trying to map it to Arc, right, which is what you'll get with the later versions of iOS for memory management. What Arc does is it's a very nice optimization from the compiler.
Right.
Right. Arc just goes in there and says, oh, look, I'm going to let you instantiate the objects, and then I'm going to call release for you at this specific time because I know that these objects going out of scope. I know nobody's referencing.
Yep.
And that's, very, the way I call it, that's very deterministic. At the end of that function, Arc's going to call it, and everything will happen. Garbage collection is different in that you have this special object, this garbage collector, that's actually not collecting memory as early as it can. It's just looking at, it's just out there allocating memory to you, and then out of the sudden it says, oh, I need more memory. And that's when it says, oh, I'm going to go and do a sweep. And it goes and looks at all the objects and says, oh, look, all these objects are no longer being referenced, so I'm going to release them. So it's non-deterministic. It happens whenever the garbage collector wants. I'll talk later about the patterns that we use to make things a little bit more deterministic. And if you're really, really, concerned about memory, or you have, for example, in some cases, let's say you have a game and you want to design, you're moving to the next level. So that's a great time to say, oh, I'm going to go ahead and garbage collect the previous level. So we do give you APIs so you can call GC collect. But for the most part, it's not recommended. I think outside of game scenario or things where you know, like, oh, here I have some free cycles that I know that I can collect against. If you let the actual garbage collector do its job, it kind of ends up with a better experience, better performance out of everything.
Like in the games, you'd only want to manually call the garbage collector because the user's already waiting at like a loading screen or something like that.
Yep.
Doing it when scrolling or something through a large list would be horrible and would be a jittery experience for the user. Not something we'd want to do.
Yep. So with that, let's get into C#. Now that you know it's garbage collected and runs on the .NET runtime, let's get into C# and let's talk about the features. Coming from Objective-C, you're going to see that we have a lot of the same features. I'm doing mappings here. And
excellent.
If you're an Objective-C developer, a lot of this is really basic stuff when I try to introduce you to classes. So bear with me as I kind of read through these slides and point out some samples. And we'll try to get as fast as we can. So for us, when we declare classes, we actually use the class keyword right here. So this is just, in Objective-C where you declare the add interface and the class for forward declarations. In our world, we use class. That's how we declare them. So the keyword is used to declare the actual implementation of the class. Our classes are actually done usually on one file. We don't have like a header file and a .m file. We have one file where we have the implementation for example, here I'm declaring properties or methods, and the implementation is right there, it's inlined. You can have partial classes, which is, hey, I can declare one class in three or four different files, and then the compiler will merge them together. But that's still not separating header from implementation. When you have whenever you declare a property or a method, you actually have to declare the implementation right there. You don't split them up with a header and an M file. So that's kind of what we have with classes. We're object-oriented, so we do, inheritance and polymorphism. So we have access modifier, public, private, protected, concepts that everybody learns in college a little bit regardless of the language, whether it was Java or C++. Most people are familiar with the concept of public being something that you can access from anywhere, private being something that you can only access from within your class, protected, something you can access as you inherit. And then we do have this special keyword that we use in C# a lot called internal. And what that is when you declare something internal, it's public within the scope of the assembly. So within the scope of the library that you're accessing it, it's public for everybody. And then anybody outside of that library, it looks to them like it's private. So they just don't see it. We have the concept of members, and member is the kind of the generic term that we use for anything that's in a class. So it's kind of the data in a class. We have fields, methods, properties. All of these we're going to flesh out as we go. So I'm just giving you the term so that as you hear me talk about a member, you don't laugh. That's the actual term that we use. It's not that kind of member. With regards to encapsulating, or properties is a good way to encapsulate properties. This is the exact same than Objective-C property.
Right. And using the getters and setters here is kind of much like using a synthesize manually in the implementation file.
Yep. So for example, here we for as a property, we kind of you declare as a property. You just use this special syntax where you declare a getter and a setter. The automatically synthesized is like right here where we have a get dot get semicolon set semicolon. That's the equivalent of the auto-synthesize. If you want to write your own getter, you can. So you can actually just do curly right here on the get.
I think
and
you had it on the last slide, actually.
Business logic. So, So this slide right here has a property called datetime. This is a nullable datetime. So that's why it might look a little bit different. That's why the question mark. But this is just a property where I can say return birthday, and I have the field. Mm-hmm. So I did an auto-synthesize here, whereas in this syntax, it's auto-synthesized. You have both options. And of course, they follow all the access modifiers and everything else.
And for those instance variables, or IVARs as we know them in iOS, note that even the same convention of underscore is very popular in C# as well as in Objective-C.
That's very religious. So some days I write underscore, other days I don't. If you look at the .NET, the recommendations and the kind of the guidelines that we use, they don't use underscore.
Okay. I've seen it done lots of different ways. But.
Yeah. I'm so old that I remember M underscore from my C++ where we used to do M underscore variable name. So that's kind of where it came from. And I go with some days I do it, some days I don't. Very, very inconsistent.
There's lots of M's in the C# that comes from Java programmers too.
Yep. So perfect. Methods is what we call for, calling an object to execute an operation. This is the same than a message in Objective-C. So it's our similar functionality to the message in Objective-C. Later when we talk about strong type, et cetera, you'll see there's a few differences. In our case, methods are strong types, and they resolve at compile time. There will be ways where I can show you how not to resolve it at compile time, but by default, we're very strong type and resolve at compile time. We have the concept of method overloading, where you'll see one method that, the exact same method name, and it just kind of comes down and has different parameters. Very much like Objective-C, where if you look at the function being the whole length with all the parameters and names and everything, we have the exact same thing. Right. The difference that I would say between our overloading and what we see in Objective-C is that in our case, we go by just the types and the parameters, so the names don't matter at all.
Right.
We look at the name of the method, and we look at the types and the parameter, and that's all you can overload.
Right. And so overloading isn't really even a thing in Objective-C, because every method, every time you add a parameter, you're actually changing the signature of the method, and by definition, a new method, rather than overloading an existing one. Yep.
But you can have two that have the exact same kind of name, and then just have different signature as we go through the parameters. It's the exact same concept as we go. Fields, as you mentioned earlier, fields are just I-bars. They're declared the exact same. They're scoped within your class, and they follow the access modifiers. So there's nothing interesting there. We do have a keyword for static. So this is static across the board. And the one thing that we have in C# is you can declare static anything. You can have static properties, static members, or static methods. You can even have static classes. And the way I think of statics, if I was mapping it to Objective-C, it's kind of what a class method is, a static, from an object-oriented standpoint. Obviously, C still has a static keyword.
I wouldn't try to bring any preconceived notions if you're coming from Objective-C as far as what the static keyword will do in Objective-C. Don't try to translate that onto C#. It's really much different.
Yep.
It's very much like a type and modifier in C# versus like a visibility or scope thing for variables in Objective-C.
So think about it again. A class method is the way I think for the methods, and we can have them as properties, so that's slightly different.
Mm-hmm.
We have constructors, so this is just the term we use for initializers. That's kind of the C++ Java term, so hopefully people are familiar with. And this is just a constructor. It gets called. It does two things. It allocates the memory and it initializes the variable. So this is our equivalent of the initializers with an alloc init all in one line, just being called by the initializer. And we have very similar concepts to what we have in Objective-C, where, for example, here I have this person is just calling the default initializer, which is the one that takes a string. And you'll see this will be the default initializer because everybody else might be calling onto it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So we have the exact same ability to chain them and do anything you want. With regards to initialization.
Mm-hmm.
We also have or use the term finalizers, which is destructors if you come from a C or C++ world or Java world. These are our finalizers, our destructors, and these are called whenever the object's finalized. Remember, we said earlier, our garbage collector is non-deterministic. So this is not something we kind of have people rely on. Don't rely on finalizer. Don't rely on these being called for you to release some important object. Obviously, the equivalent of a finalizer would be calling release and then having your destructor in Objective-C be called. Again, it's not the pattern we use. What we use is we use this thing called dispose pattern, which is you write your class and then you implement this little interface called iDisposable. And I haven't told you what an interface is. An interface is like a protocol. So you implement right here iDisposable. And then, anybody that looks at your class is going to look at it and just by kind of like convention, they're going to be like, oh, it implements iDisposable, so I have to call dispose. And what we do with C# is give you this convenience using block where I can just go back and say using, and then I declare variables there that are disposable, and then C# would automatically call dispose for me. Mm-hmm. So for example, here I have a data reader which maybe has access to a buffer or a string, and it needs to be released because I don't want to hold on to that or I don't want that to stay alive until garbage is collected. So if I just put it inside this using right here, at the end of this, reader.dispose is going to be called, and then in reader.dispose right here, I can release all my resources. So that's kind of where we're going to be at. We have the concept of abstract classes in C#. And if you think about inheritance, right, obviously you inherit from a class, you derive from a class, and you inherit that functionality. An abstract class is a class that cannot be instantiated, but it has functionality that you can inherit. Yep. So this is not like implementing a protocol because you're actually inheriting the functionality. But the class is declared abstract, and then nobody can actually just say new whatever. In this case, people manager is an abstract class, so nobody can come in and say, oh, new people manager. You actually have to have, for example, a dev manager, which derives from a people manager, and there I can do I can implement the right functionality and then new that object.
And we don't really have anything like that in Objective-C.
Yeah, there's nothing like that in Objective-C. It's pretty useful because you get to inherit functionality and you get to enforce what things must be overwritten. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of where we have. For example, right here, I have these abstract method do work. So for example, dev manager right here is inherited from people manager, and if I don't implement do work, the compiler is going to give me an error. So I declare my class, and I have some functionality that I want to inherit, like for example, the property here for direct reports, and maybe the ability for a manager to schedule meetings, because we all know that's all they do. And then, you know, the do work comes down to the type of work that they do, right? So here, if I'm a dev manager, maybe I'll get some coding. I think all dev managers should just get snacks. That's why I hinted of that. As you're looking at
it. Or, just leave the implementation of that one empty.
Yeah, leave them alone. Is that the case? We have we also have seal classes, and the seal class is one that cannot be inherited. I don't code seal classes a lot, so I don't think people will need them as much. But one thing that you'll see a lot, especially as you come onto the .NET framework, is that you will see that a lot of our framework classes are sealed.
Right.
And this is where, for example, if you think about string, that's a type that in our world it's immutable. It's kind of like any string where, it's immutable. It has certain optimizations. So the .NET framework, the guys at Microsoft that are coding the language say, hey, we're going to make optimizations so we don't want anybody to inherit from it,
right.
Such that they don't assume certain things or they don't break certain assumptions that we made.
And I think a lot of these types, too, that are also sealed are the types that are provided by WinRT. So as we get into it later, and we'll see like file pickers and storage files, storage folders, those sorts of types are all sealed because they actually come from WinRT, which is the layer below .NET that we'll probably see more about here soon.
Yep. Earlier when we talk about projections, right, anything that's WinRT will have to be sealed because we have to project against
right.
it. So when we expose the object, we make them seal by convention, and that way you can access across language, we generate the metadata and all of that. So yes, that's exactly right. So, and I'm just telling people because they're going to see them.
Yeah.
Continuing on object-oriented and object orientation inheritance, we have the concept of virtual and override. So from any class, I can declare a virtual property or a virtual method, and this is something that I'm letting somebody that derives from me actually just override.
Mm-hmm.
So for example, if I have a class called car, and I want anybody to override the model name, I have this property right here called model, and I just declare it as virtual. And with C#, what we do is when you go in there and, for example, here declare this RAV4 car and you want to override the model, you use the override keyword. If you don't use the override keyword, the compiler is going to come back and give you a warning and say, hey, are you trying to override something? So you have to, it's just a kind of a safety check. You can still get away with it. We can do an override or a new keyword, but it's something the compiler does just to prevent errors. So it's a nice extra feature that you have.
Mm-hmm.
And again, all you get is a warning. You don't get an error. So you will compile your code if you feel that that's annoying and you want to do that.
It's always good to be verbose for things like that.
Yep.
Yeah.
So, and here we get to the concept of interface. An interface is a protocol, right? That's where you declare kind of a contract that, a class or anybody that implements your interface is going to implement. Right? So interface is nothing but a protocol. The one thing that's different about our interface is that when you declare an interface or when you declare that you implement an interface, you must implement every method. So we don't have, or every property. Everything that the interface outlines, you will have to implement. You can just do no work, throw an exception or whatever. So you can just go in there and put an empty method, but you do have to implement it. If you're missing one method or a property, the compiler is going to complain that you haven't implemented the object. So there's
right.
no optional.
There's no equivalent of add optional, like
yep.
we get in Objective-C protocols.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So again, with abstract classes and other ways, you can do
right.
a little bit of that. Our interface are strong type, and they can actually support inheritance. So for example, here I can define an iProgrammer interface, and then I go back and create an iOS programmer interface that inherits from iProgrammer, right? And in the end, programmers write code, but you know, there might be different frameworks that they're using, or there might be different technologies that they know. So I kind of went back and, you know, did a little bit of inheritance there just to show you. And this is all strong types, so I can cast them as I go back. If you look at this code snippet, I can declare, for example, an iProgrammer who's a web programmer, and web programmer who's a web programmer, and then I can cast back and forth. And the compiler is going to be looking at it, making sure that I don't call methods that are only in web programmer and are not in iProgrammer if that's how I declared it. If I need to cast the objects because I know that this iProgrammer is a web programmer, I can do that.
Yeah.
Right? And we're going to talk about those in a minute. So so you see here that, again, strong type, and you know, they go through inheritance, and you can do cast them, you can cast them as you go. Right? So that's kind of at the top level with regards to class declarations and everything else. That's the principles of object orientation that we follow. If you come from Objective-C, everything there should be familiar. Everything that you're familiar with, you will have the ability to implement and do the exact same, find equivalent functionality. Moving down a little bit to the lower level, let's talk about the type system. Our type system, we have two different types, or two kind of two types of types, I guess, two categories. We have something we call value types and then reference types. Value types are where anything that's a struct, like int, float, decimal, bool, anything that where we just allocate the memory, and the big thing is that we copy these by value.
Right.
So if I declare an integer, and you know, integer A, and I assign it to integer B, when I go and update A, B was had just a copy of the value, so it's not going to get updated, right? That's what we declare as a value type. So we kind of declare the variable, and then we copy it back and forth as we go. And then we have the concept of reference type, which is what you're most familiar with. That's kind of where you spend most of your time in Objective-C, you know, when you're looking at anything that inherits from any object. Those are just references. And what you have there is, for example, if I declare a string A and a string B, A will point to B, right? And then, or for example, you have an object called person, and both Eric and I have a reference to that. If he updates a property called first name, I'm going to see that change too because we're both holding a reference onto that object.
Right.
Again, this is very, very much what you get out of Objective-C.
Right.
And this is in C#. This is where you're going to spend most of your time anyway, so you're going to be very familiar. You won't have to worry about copying or anything like that.
Yeah, and if we go back to that slide real quick.
Which one?
Yeah, those value types in C#. When you're using them on for Windows Store apps, practically they're aliased to the WinRT types as well, right? So there are those types when you use them and instantiate them. .NET's not actually doing the heavy lifting of doing work with those types. It's WinRT runtime beneath it doing that. And then reference types in Objective-C, we get to use them like object or pointers to an object, and we can do pointer math on them and all that sort of stuff. But in C#, you don't get to do that. It's more of a reference that actually acts the same as kind of the pointers, but doesn't let you, or well, you don't get to do the same sort of math and that kind of things on it.
Yep.
So
they're references, and then, yeah, you should not treat them as regular pointers.
Right.
Don't do pointer arithmetic. There's ways that you can pin certain things so that you can kind of get the equivalent of a pointer, but it's not something we do, and it's something
right.
you should avoid.
There's no reason to do it in a language like C#.
Yep, there's usually no need for it. Yep. Mm-hmm. If you're going back and forth between a value type and a reference type, we call that boxing and unboxing as we go. So yeah, you can go back and forth. You'll be seamless. The compiler will do the right thing. And for the most part, it's not going to create problems for developers. Like, you know, it's just a little bit of overhead as we allocate the memory and make the copy. So it's something you need to be familiar with.
Right. In Objective-C and iOS stuff, basically, there's no explicit concept of boxing versus unboxing, but sometimes you'll find yourself in a position where you have, say, a Boolean or something, and you need to turn it into an NS number so you can store it. NS number acts very much the same as these, like the int primitives versus like integer the class does here.
Yep. And this is not, one thing that I get often is people ask, is this like bridging? Where, you know, in Objective-C, I have to bridge something when, for example, if I'm actually in an address book, and I want to assign all those things to any strings or anything like that. And this is not. This is just more. This is more equivalent of putting
right.
an integer in an n or a bool in an NS number.
Right. I think we've got the right. slides coming up that are
yep.
more like bridging.
Yep. So we do have something like bridging if you need it. When you're using Objective-C, when you're using C#, you'll be able to call methods that have parameters as out and ref. So by default, when you pass a parameter onto a method, we will pass it by value. Now, it's interesting because we have these reference types. So what does it mean to pass a reference type by the value? If we had a method that takes a person and you pass that person by value, like if I give you the person by value, Eric, into the parameter, you'd be able to say, oh, person.name equals John and mm-hmm. assign that,
yep.
right? But the one thing that you cannot do is give me back another person.
Right.
Right. So if you change what that person points to, kind of what that, what that's referencing, when I come out of that method, I'm not going to see it.
That's right.
Right. So if you want to update the reference, then you use out and ref. These are the keywords that you'll use to actually pass something where if I give you an out, I'm pretty much telling you, hey, go ahead and create this for me.
Mm-hmm.
Right. If I give you a ref, it'll be like, hey, I have an object here, or you might or might not change the reference. But if you change the reference, it's okay because I'll see the change.
Right. And right. this is similar to in C or Objective-C. When you're passing basically addresses into functions and writing to the address or using the pointer in that function as an out parameter there. It's yep. something that you've seen before, especially in the lower level core foundations C yep. APIs.
Yeah. Yep. So you're going to see that. It's pretty straightforward. We have kind of the way I look at it is everything that we do in C# is type. It's a strong type.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of times you will need, whereas you're doing cast and stuff like that, you want to do a little bit of casting back and forth, checking for specific types, etc. So we do give you keywords so that you can do these. Because in C#, what you're going to see is if you cast something to the wrong object, you will get an exception. Right. Mm. So if I take a person and I try to cast it onto an animal, right, and they're totally different, I'm going to actually get an exception. If those types are not compatible, C# will just say, oh, this is not compatible. Most of the time, the compiler is going to catch that way earlier anyway.
Right.
But there's areas where you do need, you're using polymorphism and you need to be able to check something. So what we do is we give you these two keywords, is, which is what you check to see, for example, right here, I can check if P is a person. This is the exact same that is kind of class. Mm-hmm. So I just go back and say, assert that P is a person or that EMP is a person. EMP right here is an employee, but employee, it's actually derives from person. So in this case, EMP is a person, right? And then as is what we use to kind of do to do a safe dynamic cast.
Right.
So what happens here is, for example, if I try to cast something right here where I say, oh, cast, P, which is a person, as an employee, right? That's not going to throw an exception because I'm just doing a safe cast with the as keyword, but it's going to return null. And then where the exception would happen would be if I do the cast that way and then I try to access one of the members or call a method, then that's where the exception would happen.
So this as keyword as kind of a safe type check is very much like first doing the cast in Objective-C and then testing with response to selector
to
see if it's actually that kind of object.
Yep. Exactly. And then we have a type of, which is kind of a keyword that we have. And in our case, type of is very much like calling the class method on anything. Like, for example, you have a class like NSString. I can say NSString class, and that gives me the type. And we use the exact same thing. Now, type of is something that's static that the compiler can do. So, for example, you see right here, I have a type of person. At compile time, this is actually reference or kind of like solving what the type is and then comparing against that type. Now, at runtime, I can also call getType on any object. Anything that inherits from object will have this getType method, which is going to give me the type, which again is the class.
Yeah, that's much right? like calling class. Yeah,
yep, exactly.
On any sort of Objective-C object. Yep.
And all of our casts are unsafe, so again, you have to do your own checking as you're casting along. So something that we have in C# that's very, very popular, and you're going to see a lot, is generics. And generics, if you come from C++, it's templates,
mm-hmm.
right? And we use these a lot. You'll see for us, for example, we'll have like here, I'm declaring a list of int, as opposed to declaring list of objects. Like if you think about NS array, there you can put anything, but it has to inherit from, it has to be an NS object.
Right.
On our world, we can just go in there and just create generic specialized types that will be, oh, this is a list and it can be of any type, and you just tell it what type it's going to be.
Of course, if you said like list of type object, then it would function much the same way as an array in Objective-C would, or NS array, where there's no type checking. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, you could have a dictionary of type object an array of type object, and it would be the exact same thing you get out of Objective-C. For us with generic, you'll see that actually the framework, like we used to have all the non-generic types, like we used to have array in .NET 2.0, and it used to take object, and they do all the casting and the boxing and the unboxing. But obviously, there's performance implication there because we have to box and unbox things. And then the type safety and the compiler checks are not available there if you're just casting a lot. So we kind of started deprecating a little bit of those. And what you're going to see is that everywhere, you know, where you see our documentation, our samples, and even our APIs, you will see that we're very much specialized and aiming towards generic. But you'll have functionality if you just want to throw everything in object and keep your code familiar to what you know. Mm-hmm. So our generics are extensible, so you can write your own generic class. So, you know, in the past, I show you stack. This is stack with a generic type. It's a type that ships in the framework, so it's list. But here I kind of group, and I'll show you the samples for all of these in a minute. I won't walk through every single sample, but here I kind of declare a group stack just to give you a feel for the flavor of declaring kind of a generic class. So here I'm declaring a class called public group stack, and I'm saying T is going to be a generic type. Now you can see, for example, here I'm saying this type is actually inheriting from stack of T. So that actually inherits all the functionality. I didn't have to write a lot of functionality to get a group stack. And then I can also apply constraints. For example, I can say where T, which is my generic type, it has to implement iComparable. Mm-hmm. So if I try to declare a group stack of something that doesn't implement iComparable, the compiler is going to complain and say, hey, you can't do this. Yep. So there's a lot of type safety and a lot of functionality that I can reuse by doing that inheritance and doing that, applying those constraints. So for the most part, I guess business logic, you will write some generic classes. But if you're an iOS person coming onto C#, you don't have to worry. You won't be creating generic classes as much.
You'll be consuming them a lot, though.
Yeah, you have to know how to consume them. That's the big deal. And you're going to see plenty of samples today on that. If you want to inspect things at runtime, kind of like, for example, take a person and then look at the type and say, oh, what methods does this have? What properties do we have? In the .NET world, we call that reflection. So look in the system.reflection namespace, and you will have APIs there to access all the metadata and even to invoke the methods in there and the members in there. So you can get a type and open it up, look at all the properties, call onto those properties, set values on those properties, call the methods, and do all kinds of functionality there by just calling it. So you'll see here in this example, for example, I have a type person, and then I just went in and got the type, and then I'm enumerating all the property names and enumerating the current property value by using this get value. So you can see here, I'm going into person and saying, oh, give me the value for this property. And in this case, I'm assuming that, you know, that they're strings or it's returning them a string because I'm doing the property info, and this will do the toString on that. And then I can also come back here and say, hey, give me all the declare methods on the type, and then, you know, go ahead and find the one called greet that has only one parameter, and then call that with a, hey, you know, like this will be a greeting John. Right. So I'm passing and invoking here, passing an array of the parameters. In this case, just one with the name Hi John or whatever we're going to use.
And this is anybody who's ever done any sort of inspection on the Objective-C runtime will feel really at home with the reflection namespace. Provides almost all of the exact same functionality as those class underscore methods that are in iOS and Objective-C runtime.
Yep. Yeah, so this is all, again, what you should expect coming onto C# is all the same functionality. A little bit stronger type, but you know, you'll be able to get away with a lot of things, and I'll show you in a few minutes as we go into implicit data types and dynamic types, even more familiar stuff. So here, the other thing that we have is in C#, we have this new keyword called bar, and this is where we can declare kind of implicit data types. So for example, right here, I can say barster equals, this is a string, and the compiler can look at that and say, oh, look, this stir is going to be of type string, and it actually infers the type.
Right.
So this is not something that's on type. This is not something that, you know, like becomes, or that's an object. The compiler is actually looking at it and saying, oh, I'm going to infer the type, and I'm going to make a guess.
You can think of the step almost as like the word var gets replaced with the string, the class, in that first example, before the compilation even happens, really.
Exactly.
Yes.
And this is first of all, it's a new feature. It kind of came later onto the framework. It's been there since, I believe, .NET 3.5 or maybe .NET 4. So it's definitely in everything for Windows Store apps. And it's something that I still have mixed feeling about because it's convenient to type it like that, especially for demos. I can type bar and change the types as I go. But once I get into real code, I kind of like to stay a little bit stronger type and declare the right things to begin with so that I'm not leaving it to the compiler to infer something. But it's something that I, so you can use. Where it's used a lot more is kind of an anonymous type. In .NET, we have this concept of an anonymous type where I can say, for example, right here, I have this code, and I say bar AA equals new name. If you don't mind going to the slide. Yep. Bar AA equals new name, new. And then this is actually declaring an anonymous type. I'm declaring a new type call that has a property called name and a property called age, right? And then I can go back there and, for example, interact with that and get a type, and it's going to give me, oh, that's an anonymous type. So the compiler is actually generating that for me behind the scenes, and that's the anonymous type that they gave it. If you try it on your own, you'll get a totally different type depending on what you declare in your project, right? But you can go in there and, for example, then I can call aa.name. Or I can call aa.age. And if I try to access some method or some property called undefined, something that's actually not in the anonymous type, the compiler will actually detect that and automatically give me an error at compile time. This is not a runtime.
Right.
Right. So that's what a bar will do. It's kind of an implicit data type, and that's what is useful for kind of building anonymous types on the fly, which is convenient when I'm reading JSON or doing certain things. Bringing data from a server, it's kind of convenient for parsing to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Everything there is still strong type. So the one thing, if you don't want to be strong type, what we have is we give you a dynamic keyword. And if I go back here and I declare something, like for example here, I have a dynamic DA object. When we declare something dynamic, we tell the compiler, hey, please remove all type checking until the runtime. Right? So this is very much like Objective-C does, right? So
right.
With Objective-C, I can just send send any message, and then at runtime, it might or might not work. And with dynamic, we do the exact same thing. I can just declare, for example, right here, I have, again, the anonymous type, and if I try calling aa.undefined, the compiler will give me an error with the implicit type. But if I declare this DA as dynamic, then the compiler will not give me an error when I try to call da.undefined. The method's still undefined, so what happens is at runtime, I'm going to get an exception. Something you will see throughout, as we go throughout the day and everything, is in .NET and C# and Windows Store, we throw a lot of exceptions. Objective-C
right.
exception is kind of a very one-off case. Like, it's not used for logic or
in Objective-C, exceptions are usually programmer error. Like, you made a problem when writing your code, and you should change it if you're throwing Objective-C exceptions.
Yep.
They're not used for program control flow or anything like that.
Yep. And in C# and .NET, we tend to use that a lot more for control flow. So if you, for example, call a method, you will get an argument or invalid argument exception, or you will get a lot of exceptions that way. We tend to do that a lot more. So that's definitely a difference that you're going to see. Another difference that you're going to see here is you'll see on these little code samples, I wrote debug.writeline and assert a lot. Writeline is the equivalent of log. Just nslog, just putting stuff on the console because I was using it for samples. But the one thing that for us is if you write assertions, in our case, the debug.assertions get stripped out as your code ships.
Right.
So if you write debug.assert, that gets stripped out, where if you're in Objective-C and you write assertions, those stay there.
That's true of everything in that systems diagnostics namespace, right?
Yep. Well, okay. I don't know if it's everything in system diagnostics.
Or at least the debug.
But definitely the debug object, okay. All of that will get stripped out.
Okay.
So assertions, write lines, all of that gets stripped out as we compile for release, if anything that's in system diagnostics. And that's a fair point that debug.writeline is actually system.diagnostics.debug.
Right.
You'll see the shortcuts here. I'm kind of going to give you all the theory, and then we'll walk through a couple samples because I think this is very introductory, so I don't want to waste developers' time with giving them the introductory stuff. I'm just giving them the context, and then I'll show you the samples, and you'll be able to download the samples and play with them offline. Null is our version of nil, and when an object is set to null, it indicates that its value is set to nothing. If you have a reference type and you just declare it, like you can say, person P, that person has been assigned null by default. It started with nil and everything else. Very similar to nil. I think the only difference that I could think of is that when you're doing kind of Boolean evaluations in C#, you actually have to check for something equal to null. You can't just say if object, And then have it be like, oh, if object was not null, like, because I can go in there and say if object, and if that object was nil, I can just write that short syntax. In C sharp, you actually have to do the comparison, say if object equals null.
Right.
So that's the only difference that we have there. With regard to programming flow, every programming language has about the same flow, so you're not going to expect anything different from C sharp or for Objective-C. You have if, loop, for loops, do while, for each, switch, you know, all of them are the same. I have a link right here to all the C sharp keywords, which will give you, if you go in there and just look at the keywords, you will see what we use for loops and what we use for control flow and everything else, because those keywords should be familiar to anybody that knows C, Java, C++, so they'll be the same.
Just to interrupt you real quick, partial classes are coming, right? I've been seeing a question popping up quite a few times
So
when we're going to get to them and cover them.
We'll get into partial classes. We'll do a little bit of a code walkthrough to some of these, again,
okay.
And then we'll talk about partial classes in a minute. I did a type map in here where I said, oh, here's some of the C-sharp types, and here's the iOS types that we're familiar with. String, array, that's actually an interesting one. When you're using array, dictionary, list, everything in .NET, by default, we're mutable.
Mm-hmm.
So if you come from the iOS world, you're more familiar with, oh, I have an array and I have mutable array. On our world, we're mutable by default. In fact, we have very few types that are not mutable. String is unmutable. You make a copy of the string. Again, it's sealed. We optimize it quite a bit. And then we have a lot of types here where you'll see generics. For example, if you're looking for the equivalent of NS sets, we'll have a hash set, a sorted set, and they'll be generic types, so you can actually apply your types. So these are kind of very basic types. Over here, you have kind of more native types. These are my value types, int, char, float. These are mapped exactly the way to what we do with Objective-C, or literally the C angle, the C angle in Objective-C.
Right.
Our bool is actually true, and it's strict. So we don't have yes, no, we don't do 0, 1. We literally do true and false.
Right.
That's what we do a lot more in Objective-C.
It's true or false, not false in anything else that is true.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Callbacks and events. Here, this is interesting because we use the term delegate. And for us, the delegate term, which is going to be probably the most used term in Objective-C, for us, it has a different meaning. Add delegate is a function pointer. It's like a block. Actually, type function pointer. Yeah. So it's a strong type reference to a method. It's a block, and it's a typed block.
Right.
So that's what a delegate is. I know it's going to drive you crazy. Interface and protocols, I can go back and forth. When I have a conversation, we talk about delegates. That gets a little bit more confusing. But again, delegate is just a strong type method, right? A reference to a method. It's a type def on a block. That's what it is. You're going to see us cover that a little bit as we go. Earlier I showed you anonymous types. We can also do anonymous method, and this is exactly the same than a block, right? So anywhere or from here, I can, for example, say, oh, the loaded event handler for here is going to be a delegate, and I can declare on the fly just like I could declare a block in the fly, a completion handler or something like that on the fly. That's an anonymous type. Again, these are strong type. The compiler is actually doing the work ahead of time. So there's more work that the compiler is doing, but that's all behind the scenes, so you don't have to worry about it. We also have the concept of lambda expressions. This is a little bit more advanced. What we do here is a lambda expression is a shorter syntax onto the way we declare, anonymous delegates and, you know, function callbacks. So rather than, you know, declaring every parameter and its types and everything else, we kind of are letting the compiler do a little bit of inheritance, a little bit of a kind of implicit typing, where, for example, here I can say unsorted delegate sort, and I have two parameters, first and second, right? And the compiler is going to look at the types of the things I'm passing in, and it's going to infer the types, and then it's going to go back and say, oh, you know, because here I'm doing a comparison. This is my delegate sort. It's just doing comparison. It's just going to declare return true, or it's going to declare the return first minus second. So let's assume these are two integers. If I plus 1 and 2, it's going to say, oh, you know, 1 minus 2 is -1, so this number is smaller. And you can see there how we could do a delegate sort. You'll see the code in a minute. Lambda expression is more advanced. You will see a lot of our samples use them, so you'll get familiar with the syntax, but don't worry if you don't want to learn how to write them. Everybody could tells me, oh, the syntax is so hard to understand. It takes a week. You don't have to ever write a Lambda expression. You can just write full-blown declarations, and it's just a little bit more typing.
I'll be honest. I find the Lambda syntax much easier than the Objective-C block syntax. So.
Well, fair, but yeah. That's comparing, you know, that's comparing two things that are, like, right. Comparing it to something that's complex already. But yeah, that's a fair point. It's an optional thing, I guess, is where I was going. Events, you have objects, and your object can have, you know, just like they can have properties, they can have this special type of property, which is an event, which actually is a special delegate. And this is where delegation happens to us. With events, if you're coming from, you know, the Objective-C world and you're used to delegation, event, and I'll show you the sample for events for sure, is where you're going to see, oh, here's how we kind of delegate things. Now, we don't do, again, in Objective-C, what I see is you have the protocol, you define it, and that becomes your delegate. So it's kind of your contract where it's, you know, in .NET, that'll be the interface. Mm-hmm. In our world, we tend to be, we just declare the events, and that's kind of the contract. So for example, if you look at a page, it's definitely going to have four or five methods that are kind of a delegate with events like loaded, unloaded, things that you would expect. But in our case, they're declared events.
In that way, the delegate pattern, the way they end up being used, is very similar to the way it is in iOS, where basically the delegate is the thing that is doing something another object wants it to. And we hook into those events through an Objective-C using a protocol, and in this case, using delegate methods directly, where we subscribe directly to that event handler, or we subscribe our event handler directly to that event.
Yep. And that fits well, too, also with regards to earlier we said, you know, in our case, if we had interfaces, you would have to implement all the interfaces.
Right.
Whereas, you know, in Objective-C, because you can have optional methods on the interface or the protocol, you wouldn't have to implement everything. What we do here is, for example, this airport class can have 10 different events, and I just need to land to listen for one.
Right. It's not necessary for you to subscribe to all of them.
Exactly.
If you don't want to. Right.
Yep.
Because
exactly.
It's opt in, not opt out, or implement some or all.
In parallel, if we declare six and you want three of them, you will have to do plus equal on the three that you want to subscribe to. So you'll see right here, and I'll give you if we walk through the syntax, you'll see I have a class called airport, and it has an event that, you know, it's called flight arrived. And you see that whenever we declare events, we tend to declare a type for the event so that we can, you know, something that inherits from the event arc, so that we have kind of a base class that we all know to adhere to and a convention to follow.
Right. This is just also more of that type safety to make sure the event you have hooked up will get all of the right arguments from the parameters that the event has.
Yep. And then you see here how from within the class, how I fire the event, I have my, you know, land, you know, let's say I have a method where the plane is landing, and then I just go in there and said, oh, you know, go ahead and get a reference to the event. And then if somebody subscribed, this would not be null. So if I say if EH not equals null, this is where I'm checking somebody's listening. Otherwise, there's no reason to fire it. And then I just call onto it very much like I would call a block, right? And then this is firing and it's calling back onto whoever subscribed to. And then that person can do kind of their delegation where they can do their work there.
Right. And this code, actually, a question had popped up earlier, and this is a good place to just kind of answer it and mention it. But that check against EH does not equal null is because trying to call messages or methods on null objects will result in an exception, and that's why you do have to guard against that sort of thing in Objectives or in C Sharp.
Yep. Yeah, so in our world, if you have something that's null and you try to send a message or call a method, you will get an exception if it's null. Mm-hmm. So we won't ignore it or anything like that. So here's the syntax. So the left-hand side right here with airport has how we declare and how we fire the event. Here you have somebody consuming the event, which is what most developers will do a lot, consuming the events that we have on the framework. And you'll see here I'm just declaring a new airport, and then we use this plus equal to subscribe to the event. So that means, you know, if you implement it, you can subscribe and unsubscribe whenever you want. It's not like you're implementing the full delegate and, you know, everything's wired by default.
In this whole subscribe, unsubscribe thing, the terminology is actually very similar to Notification Center in the way that you, for like, add yourself as a handler for a certain event and then remove it later when you're done.
Yep, yeah. Exactly. So we kind of merge those, but this is the way we do delegations. Think about it as observer. The more generic term that I could use was think about it as an observer. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it is the observer pattern. Right? Yep, I believe both are, and it's just slightly different implementations of what's going on.
There's a few things that I didn't cover, but you'll see, or a few that I have samples here, and then a few that you're going to see in the sample. We have the concept of extension methods, which is very much like categories in Objective-C. Mm-hmm. Like, let's say I want to add a method to compare a string, or to see if a string starts with a digit. A string was a sealed class, so you see here that the framework declared a seal. I cannot touch it, but I can go back and add an extension method. And the way we do that, it was just declaring a static class, and we declare a static method that has this special keyword, this is the equivalent of self.
Right.
For us, like whenever we're doing object-oriented, self and these are about the same. And in this case, when we declare the method, we have the special keyword that says, oh, this is going to be an extension method onto string. So from here, we know that I can have, this is an extension method for string. We don't declare it the way we do categories. Now, this could have other parameters, so I can have this string I and then pass other parameters if I was, appending or doing something else with the string. So this is how we implement extension methods, which, again, is categories. I mentioned this earlier. We have the concept of partial classes, which you see in a lot of these samples, as I get to them in a minute. And a partial class is just one class that's declared across multiple files. Mm-hmm. This is a pattern that we use a lot just out of the box, because everything that we do for UI, you will have the design time, which is the SAML, and all the things that we use that the designer is generating. And then that designer is going to generate code. And you see all these generated files that are kind of hidden somewhere, but they exist. Mm-hmm. And you should never, ever modify them, but you can go see them and see how things are coming together.
And we're going to look at that later on, right?
Yeah, when we cover SAML, we'll definitely dive through that concept.
Because when we see the UI for Windows Store apps and what's happening in there, there's actually going to be three partial classes that all come together to form what's actually shown on the screen for you.
Yep, exactly. So those are it. There's more. There's a few things that I didn't cover. Some of them you'll see later in the day. Some of them you will not. Async and await and the whole concept of async programming we're going to dive into a lot later in the day. I did not get deep into link, which is kind of our language intermediate query, or it's an
integrated natural query.
Natural query, which is just ways to be able to select and filter on objects that implement iNumerals, so collections.
Mm-hmm. And it actually ends up looking pretty beautiful, too, when you have a lot of link code that's doing something powerful.
Yeah, there's a lot of power to link. It's very optional. You can write plenty of apps without ever using link, but if you're dealing with data a lot, link gives you a lot of functionality that that you could benefit from. I didn't get deep into serialization, and I did mention exception handling and the fact that we use exception handling a lot more for control flow than we do with that. And that's kind of my really deep, kind of like brief overview of everything in the on the language. I'm going to dive in to give you a couple samples so you get familiar with the language. I just didn't want to go back and forth as much so that I can come back here and do a little bit of, showing you a little bit of the code as we went. Everything that you saw, every single code snippet that you saw on those slides, you'll be able to see in this sample. Mm-hmm. So you'll come back here and be able to find property, methods, generics, everything that we showed you there, you'll be able to come to this sample and then debug into it and everything else. So so for example, here I have the event one, which is already open, which I thought, because that event is a very, very important concept.
Might want to bump up your phone
understand.
A little bit.
Oops. I've been switching back and forth with Express and non-Express. Mm. So, cool.
There you go.
That's probably better.
That's much better.
Yep. So here I have that same airport class that you saw, and you'll see the method right here, landing the plane. And you'll see how it declares the event. And we have a generic event handler. This just makes it easier. You'll see here flight arrive event arcs. It's just actually, I can say go to definition here. It takes me to where that class was defined. And I can go see right here that it inherits from event arcs. That's usually the convention that we use so that we have kind of a base that we know we can query on. And then here it just has an extra parameter, and it's an extra property. So you see here, this is a property, public, and this is the constructor. So you're seeing all of the concepts that we talked about, right? You can see a little bit of that. I'll run it in a minute, and you'll see it in the debugger. So you'll see here, you'll see it on the debugger here. Here's a sample. You'll see, actually, I have this partial class samples, which is declared. every single one of the snippets has this one method for this partial class. So there's one class called samples, and they all have the one method that I'm using, because I declare the sample for that class right here is listening to events, but the whole class is called samples. That includes all the samples. You'll see in a minute when I'm referring to that. So here I'm going to instantiate the object, and then I'll subscribe to the event right here, flight arrive, and then I'll land a few planes, and you'll see that flight arrive will be firing and everything else. So you'll see that in a minute. Let me show you one more sample just so we can walk through a couple. Here's the generic type that we showed. Here's our group stack. You'll see the type of T. All that group stack does is it kind of pops items in groups. So for example, if I have a group stack that goes by, you know, three items at a time, whenever I push or pop something, I can push one individually because I didn't write that functionality. But when I pop something, I kind of want to pop, you know, two or three items at a time, whatever the end, whatever number is for we're looking at. And you'll see here, here's the partial class again. And I just called it conveniences, and then I just added implementation of that stack. So I added a generic stack, and then I can, you know, do pushing stuff and taking stuff out of the stack. And just for constants, I actually wrote the type before I had generic, so you'll see functionality right here. So I have array, object, and I can create an instance and then put objects into it. This is boxing and unboxing everything. I have to get value and, you know, do all the right things to be able to access. So this is kind of, without generics, what the code would look like. And then here I have, you know, an implementation using generics, so you can kind of see a little bit of functionality.
Looks much cleaner with generics.
Yeah, it's much easier to read, and it's more performant, and it's actually, you know, stronger type. So it gives you better design time and compile time support.
Mm-hmm.
So all of this you'll see. Earlier on my second session today, I had problems with the debugger. So I'm going to try now to show you the debugger that I didn't show you earlier. And so that's why I put some breakpoints here. The last thing that I had that I want to show you before I show you that is right here. First of all, this is now the design time. So earlier, again, we had problems with design time. You're going to see the SAML design time a lot. So here I have just one page that has one button, and it calls onto all of these. You'll see right here, here's the page. And you'll see right here, there's just buttons, and they're all calling the same method called showSample. And you'll see in showSample how all of those, the partial classes come together. So here I have showSample, and depending on what parameter is passed in for the method, I'm just calling onto samples, which is the class, and I'm calling the right method. All of these are methods in that class that's coming together as a partial class. So I can put a breakpoint there and be okay. So that's kind of where we're at. So let's go ahead and debug it. Let me do it on the simulator so that we can see the output window here. So let's just go back here. And fingers crossed now that our problem is gone.
Excellent.
We've done a few things. We changed a little bit of our configuration, so hopefully it'll be fine. And you can see here, actually, you see our window right here is not very pretty, and I see all the buttons that I can call. I set some breakpoints earlier, so let's go ahead and show you the debug experience. I can come back here, and let's just click on event handlers, and you see here I hit the breakpoint. So the debugger, this is what our debugger looks like, and again, we didn't show it earlier, so I'll show it right here. The debugger will have... right here, many different tabs. I have my autos, which is the things that are being used. So this is automatically created by you. All of these tabs you can remove, by the way. So if you decide, hey, I don't want to ever use these tabs, like I never use autos, you can remove it. Just close it right here, and it can go away. I have a locals tab, which gives you all the local variables. This is kind of, in LLVM for me, the equivalent of doing a frame variables, mm-hmm. Where I see everything that's there in the local scope. And then I have this watch window where I can drag items, type anything I want to evaluate. So for example, right here, I can just drag this button, and I can either drag it from here, just bring it there, or I can type. I can evaluate something against the button, so I can say b.content and see what its content property is. And you see that it's evaluating all those things. So this is my watch window. I can have many of these, so I can have up to four watch windows on the debugger. So you can create two or three, depending on what method. I tend to do it where when I'm debugging something complex, I might have two different watch windows, one for kind of different scopes in the method. Here's my call stack. So you can see here, we just click on the show sample. You see all my breakpoint windows here. I have a command window where I can talk to Visual Studio. So command is where I kind of talk to Visual Studio. So for example, here, I can say help, I don't know, page. And it's going to launch the help file and show page so you can navigate. From here, I could run a batch file or a build command or anything that I wanted to.
You can also use the command line debugger here too, right? Or interface with the debugger from here.
Yeah, but, well, so the interface from the debugger is actually in this immediate window. It's slightly different. So command window is talking to Visual Studio. Immediate window, I can interface with the debugger here.
Okay, so the immediate window here would be like the equivalent of the LLDB window in Xcode or something like that.
Well, I think our watch windows are also the equivalent of that.
I just mean the console where we can type.
Is there. Mm-hmm. Yep, exactly. And so, for example, here on the immediate window, I can say, you see right here, I got b.content equals event handlers. I can just go here and type a method or a column to this property and say v.config equals Eric. And that's actually updating it right now. It updated the UI, and it's updating this property. All of it propagates, so I can interact with my code, evaluate. I can say b equals null. Right, and it's going to say false. I can, you know, do any kind of evaluation as I go. And here I have my output window. So here is where I see my login because we have debug login on this. So I'll just press F5 to continue.
And I'm going to interrupt you again one more time. There's other questions popping up. But as far as like dependency injection frameworks and entertainment libraries go, or not entertainment, like MVVM libraries, we're going to talk about that later in a coming session.
Yeah. Yep. We don't have IOCs out of the box, but there's plenty of libraries and there's plenty of frameworks that you
like Unity and MVVM Lite.
So Castle, or, you know, all the typical IOC containers or implementations are available for .NET. They're generic stuff. Mm-hmm. So here, I'm stepping onto the next. I can obviously change, set my next statement to be something else. In this case, what I want to do is I want to land the plane. Because I wanted to show you, I'm in land the plane. I have another breakpoint right there in the event. So I can just go back there and just, continue executing here. And I'm landing the plane twice. So you can see here, you see my login, my, debug logins happen there where the event fire and it says AS23 has arrived. I fired it. If you look at the code where we use this, we subscribe to the event, fire, and then it's unsubscribed, and then fire it again. So we shouldn't see another message here. So you see all the examples that we talked about. You see the debugger, everything that we saw with regards to code. You'll be able to look through these. If people want to, or for people that need to know more, because everybody will need to do more, there's a really great book called Essential C# 5.0. The problem is that it's 1,000 pages. It's a very, very in detail. It's kind of like, very much like...
Is that the O'Reilly book?
No, it's by Addison Wesley.
Okay. The O'Reilly C# in a nutshell is also, it's not very nutshell, but that's a good reference.
There's a lot of really great references. So there's the really big, thick books, 1,000 pages or so, covers absolutely everything. I think if you walk through this sample, you'll get, and then we also have really great documentation for the language on the Dev Center. So this is kind of an in-between. Walk through the sample, get through every, become familiar with it, just play with the code, put breakpoints, try to write your own person object, write your own casting, et cetera, and you'll have something to go back and forth. Honestly, learning C# or, getting familiar with C#, if you're coming from the Objective-C world, is going to be very, very straightforward. So that's it with regards to kind of C# dive for Objective-C developers. Everything that you're expecting from C#, you will be able to have. Or from Objective-C, you'll be able to find. The main difference is understand the fact that we're a little bit more stronger type, so you'll have to deal with that a little bit. And then deal with the new names, right? Delegate is an event. Or a delegate is a type dev of a block, is used for eventing. It's still a very similar concept where you're implementing delegation, but it's a different term. What protocol becomes an interface. Mm-hmm. Right, and then in, what's an interface by default becomes a class. So it's just understanding the terms.
That's probably the biggest hang-up a lot of people have is getting caught up on the terminology. But if they just watch this talk, read those slides, everything should be okay.
Yep, and I showed earlier. So for example, here our IntelliSense is very, very straightforward. So here you see I do samples dot. This is a partial class, but I can go back and forth anywhere here. And, you know, see all my classes there. If I'm looking for a different type, something we haven't used, again, I showed you this earlier, I can say button B, and then I can go find every single property. I can right-click here, and for example, you know, again, go to the definition. I can pick the definition while here so I don't have to navigate away. So all of that is available for users there. So you'll be able to go back here, navigate across the class because this button has very little functionality, so I can go to button base and see all the functionality there. So again, nothing too hard with regards to learning Objective-C.
Right.
If you come from Objective-C, another option is C++. We have C++ CX, and you'll be able to write Windows Store apps. The language there is a little bit, we have extensions on top of C++, so it's C++ as you know it, and then we have a few extensions that we use for Arc, right, for the reference counting, so it will be pretty straightforward. For this class, we chose Objective-C because, again, we see a lot of people navigating towards...
I would certainly say, or starting in C-sharp with XAML for writing Windows Store applications, you're going to have a much easier time than starting with C++.
Yep, exactly.
Especially coming from a language like Objective-C, which gives you all sorts of nice things.
Yep. So, so that's it. I don't know if you have any questions open, Eric?
I think the only one outstanding is persistent storage, and we are going to briefly cover that in one of the upcoming sessions.
Yep.
That's going to be the app model. I'm actually going to be giving that talk. And yeah, we'll talk about the storage types and what you can do in Windows to basically store user data, store user preferences, and then I'll mention SQLite, but we're not going to go too far into detail on that.
Yep. So great. So let's give them a 10-minute break,
okay,
and then we will come back next with asynchronous and some of the networking APIs. So...
All
See
right.
you in 10 minutes.